We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name is Mike Poe. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 11-18-09. It's nice to be here speaking. I always like to tell this one little thing. I don't know if any of you people have, you know, had this best friend. You had one of those guys that you would just die for, you know, like you'd do anything for him. And I always think too, like we got to protect our sobriety in the beginning. And after we've been here a while, we start helping others and we start doing things for other people. But in the beginning, you know, it's all about protecting my sobriety. So I think of this story where there was these two buddies and they were up in the mountains, and these guys would kill for each other. I mean, these guys were so tight. They'd do anything for each other. So they're up in the woods and they're walking along. All of a sudden one guy hears a noise and he looks over there and says, "What's that?" And his friend says, "That's a bear." And it's like, "Oh man, a bear, what are we going to do?" And this bear looks really mad. And they look over and it's a mama bear and she's got some cubs by her. So now this bear's starting to roar and getting angry. And these guys, you know, they have no weapons. They're just out there walking, having a hike. And remember, these guys kill for each other. So one friend asked the other friend, "Well, what do you think we should do?" And his friend says, "Well, I'm going to run." And his friend looks at him and says, "That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. Everybody knows you can't outrun a bear." And he looks at his friend and says, "I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you." So sometimes we just got to protect ourselves and keep our sobriety first in the beginning. I thought I'd go through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a way of life for me that's changed my life. Our 12 steps says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. So I'm going to share with you some of the spiritual awakenings I've had, some of the way how I've done my first step. You know, our first step says we admitted we're powerless over alcohol and our life had become unmanageable. And I don't know, there's so many ways I could identify. I started drinking. One of the first memories I have, and this is why I know what makes me an alcoholic, I can remember, and I didn't know this when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to say, I said my sobriety date, so I've been sober for 11 years. And when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would say for my first 5 years, you know, and I've been very active too in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gone to a lot of meetings, three or four meetings a day for my first 4 or 5 years. And then I still go to at least one meeting a day, sometimes more. And one of the things that I look back on though, and I used to always say I was about 15 when I started drinking, because I never really put a time frame on it. And if I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't be telling this now. I wouldn't even know it now. After some time, I don't know, in the middle of my sobriety here, my mom was visiting us, and somehow that came up that I was 15 when I started drinking. Maybe she'd heard me speak or heard me say it. And I remember she said, "Son, you weren't 15 years old. You were 11 years old when your grandmother saw you walking down the street drunk." And what that did for me, I went back in my life and I started looking like, where did we live then? I realized, dang, I was 11 or barely 11 years old and 12 years old when I had a friend that used to be able to buy us beer, an older friend of mine, and he would be able to get his uncle to buy us beer. And I started drinking at the age of 11, 12, you know, when I could get it. But here's one of the things that I remember too at that age. And this is how I kind of figured it out, because I remember the garage where this happened. And I used to go out to the garage and take a gas can, pick it up and huff on that gas can. Huff the gas in till I can remember just like falling backwards and hit my head against the wall. And why I like to share that at the beginning of my story, because here I am 11 years old and somehow I'd heard to do this. And if you did that once, I can still remember the horrible taste of the gas. You know, that's what I remember now. But at the time I went back and did it again and again and again. And it just makes me think, looking back at an 11-year-old boy wanting to get run away from something so bad, you know, through doing inventories, I've seen some of the reasons, maybe what I was running from. And without Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps, I would never know that. And I always like to tell my friends too, because, you know, I'm older. I'm 62 years old now. So when I was doing that gas, well, that was like 51 years ago. You know, it was none of that cheap gas. It was that good stuff, like ethyl they had back then. You know, none of this stuff with all the additives. I was huffing in that good gas. So, but looking back, what I was trying to run from, one of the things I think of that time, I had this grandmother, and I might talk about her a little later towards the end of my share, but I called her Nan. She was like the best grandmother somebody could ever have. She would be like, if you were a kid and you could pray for a grandmother, she was like the perfect. I mean, she would do whatever I want. She was always there for me. I mean, she was one of those grandmothers, I think, that just love having a little grandson. And my mom was barely 16 when she had me. My dad was 18. My mom was 16. So this grandmother took care of me a lot. And we lived in Simi Valley, and they lived in Sylmar. My grandmother did. And through doing the inventories, I used to always have this saying. I think my wife had heard it. I'd said it any time that when I was a teenager, I used to always tell everybody, I wish I had a tunnel where I could just go to Nan's house instead of waiting for my, you know, dad or mom to drive me over there. Where I could just take a tunnel and just, and I used to say that all the time as a kid. And through doing the inventory process, so I realized that I wasn't always trying to get to Nan's house, and I was trying to get away from my house. My parents, my mom and dad, they fought all the time, it seemed like. I remember blood on my dad's back. I remember things breaking. So when I look back at that instance huffing the gas at 11 years old, I realized I was running from something. I wasn't happy in my own home. My perception later on when I'd get married, I would, you know, just that's just a little bit of my childhood, but it was chaotic. It was alcohol all around. And I would actually tell my wife when I first got married, you know, I had a perfect child. I was just so delusional, you know. I guess because as a child, you know, my mom and dad were the people I loved the most. They were my examples. I couldn't imagine them doing wrong, I guess, in my eyes, though I sensed it was wrong. So it was very confusing. Like, I've learned this since I've gotten older. You know, I never really wanted to look at all that until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. But that, like I said, that first step, I've done that first half of that first step perfect for 11 years. I have not taken a drink. I believe it's the only step you can do perfect. And, you know, we admit we're powerless over alcohol. Here's an example. So you fast forward to where I'm 19 years old. I'd met my wife. We'd gotten married. We moved into our first apartment. And through all those years, from the age of 11 till 19, I drank. I was a teenage dope fiend. I drank from the age of 17, I'd say on. I drank probably every day. I was a total alcoholic. I had to drink every day. And came a time when we'd moved into this apartment, me and my wife, and I guess I drank so much cheap wine and did so much stuff. I had torn varices, I had bleeding ulcers, and I was throwing up blood so bad. And this was for a couple of weeks, but what I remember doing, how I know about that phenomenon of craving, it talks about in the doctor's opinion in our book. How I relate to that is that I would throw up blood in the bathroom. I remember it was like, it wasn't just a little bit of blood, it was a lot of blood. And I would pour two water glasses full of wine, set them on the counter in the bar. And after I'd throw up the blood, I'd go out and down those two water glasses full of wine as fast as I could. And I did that for, I think, a few weeks. And I ended up, I think my grandfather finally came and got me to go to the hospital. And I don't remember what happened. You know, I just remember that part I just told you, but I do know what came out of that. You know, I'm sure they told me, if you ever drink again, you're going to die. You know, I think it was pretty bad what I was doing. But here's the thing about it. The first step doesn't say we admit we're powerless over alcohol. It doesn't say we admit we're an alcoholic. It says we admit we're powerless over alcohol. So here's the thing that happened to me about 6 years ago. My wife was going through a closet, and she found this little envelope. And she said, look, Mike, what I found. She found this note that me and her both put in a note in a little 4-inch by 3-inch envelope, and it was in there. It was all faded. It hadn't been touched in, 30 years or I think something like that, 20, yeah, probably close to 30 years. It had just been in a closet. She happened to find it there and showed it to me. And what was on this note, this is what I wrote. It was in my own handwriting. It said, "I, Mike Poe, swear I'll never drink liquor again. I understand I inherited a weakness to alcohol, and I'm not like anybody else, and I'm much smarter too." And the date on that is 8/19/1979. It was a month before my 21st birthday. And what that note tells me is in our book, it says you have to concede your innermost self, you're an alcoholic. Well, it certainly looks through that note that I'd conceded myself. I knew I had a problem. I knew I was an alcoholic. But here's the thing about the first step. Like I said, it doesn't say we admit it, we're an alcoholic. It says we admit we're powerless over alcohol. And if I look back on my life at that time, if you'd have said, wanted me to say I'm powerless over alcohol, I don't think I could have said. I would have said, I'll quit when I want to quit. I'm ready to quit now, I'll quit. So I think that's why it's important, that first step, as we go along. And then we come to the second step. And it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. So here I am in the first step, I'm powerless over alcohol. And now the second step is telling me that I'm going to come to believe in a power. So maybe there's something out there that's more powerful than alcohol, more powerful than anything else. And then the second part of the second step could restore me to sanity. And through studying in Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned that insanity, what Bill was thinking when he wrote that, was the insane thinking that precedes the first drink. A guy like me, going back, I think I probably stayed sober a couple months after that instance with throwing up the blood. Probably my stomach healed up. I really don't remember how long I stayed sober. I was smoking weed and doing other things, but I didn't drink alcohol. So somewhere that insane thinking came back to me that it would be okay to drink again. A brief history about how my drinking went. So I drank like that till I was 34 years old. At the age of 34 years old, I'd like to tell you guys that I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I did the 12 steps, and life got really good. I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not what happened. I wasn't going to find Alcoholics Anonymous for another 18 years. But what I did find is I got really sick. I was in the hospital, and a doctor prescribed me a drug called Vicodin, an opiate. And from the age of 34 till 51, I did those pills. I smoked that Willie Nelson weed. I would do drugs, meth and cocaine whenever I could, but I didn't drink alcohol. And it's my wife and me, we just celebrated 43 years of marriage in November. There's something interesting about that too, that 43 years of marriage, and this is, we didn't do this on purpose, but I our anniversary is 11/7/77. And looking back, you know where I met my wife? I met her at a 7-Eleven. So it's always part, that's another part. I would never even thought of that if I wasn't thinking of something interesting to say in an AA meeting. So if there's something to numbers, that might have something to do with it. But yeah, that's a little bit of what happened. So at the age of 51, those 4 pills a day that doctor prescribed me, it turned into like, if I had 40 pills a day, I'm a walking junkie. And that's when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 51. And, like I said, that second step, the third step, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood them. And maybe that 7-Eleven story, this is something that always blows me away, that I went to church when I was 40 years old. My kids, I'd been able to put them into a Christian school. And through that Christian school, so this is how I remember it. But however it came about, there came a time where I'd only been to church one time in my life when I was a little boy. My great-grandmother took me. But my wife and my kids were going to church. And I remember thinking that I wanted to change my life. And I've always been interested in God. I always, when I was a little boy, I used to watch Billy Graham. I can remember, you know, I don't know, as a teenager probably, and I'd come home, I had this little TV in my room, probably coming home from partying and high, but I would turn that on late at night. They'd have those crusades. I'd be watching Billy Graham, and I was kind of fascinated by it. So I've always known there was something great. I've always known there was a God. And so around this time, I started going to church. I can remember asking my wife, you know, well, I have to talk to anybody. And she says, yeah, it's probably people are going to talk to you. And so I ended up going to church, and I got really involved. And I was trying to, so it tells me looking back at that time, I really wanted something different. But I was still addicted to all those things. I wasn't drinking alcohol, but I was addicted to pills, doing a lot of drugs. I was judging everybody in church, you know. But it tells me looking back, I wanted something different. I got baptized. And looking back on that too, I believe that was the beginning of a surrender for me to God. Step three, I was making a decision to turn my will and life over to God then. I made a decision, right? I went in the water. I got dunked. But it actually got worse over the next few years. You know, the drug use and all the stuff I was doing actually got worse. You know, so I started thinking maybe the water wasn't so holy. Maybe they put some dirty water in that thing. And that's not what had happened at all, though. I'd made a beginning, but I hadn't learned how to live in God's will. And it was interesting during that time in church too. This is the kind of thinking I have. You guys heard that in that note when I was 20 years old, it says I'm much smarter too. And that was in 1979. I didn't get sober till 11/8/09. So, you know, during those 30 years, I was doing my first step and I wasn't too smart. But here's how my smart thinking thought. I thought, well, I'm going to church, and they started this program called Celebrate Recovery. And this church had just opened up this, and this pastor, I went to him one day, and I said, you know, I can't stop living the way I'm living. What do I have to do, Dave? You know, I mean, I can't. I'd heard his son had a problem with addiction, so I thought maybe he could help me out. And you know what he had the nerve to say to me? He says, you just need to trust God. And I'm glad he couldn't see my thought bubble, because I probably was thinking like, you mother, you know, I mean, just trust God. Of course, we know now through the 12 steps, that's what I've come to do. But he did tell me that there was this program called Celebrate Recovery, and they were going to have different groups of addiction, the church recovery program that were different. It was for codependency, you know, overeating, all those things lumped together with God as the solution. So they would break up into groups, and they were going to need somebody to be like the head of I was going to be the head of the drug and alcohol part, because don't you know that's what I know about. But here's the thing, looking back at that, my wife would say I was so high at times during those classes that I would learn how to be the drug and alcohol counselor, the one that was going to lead those groups. And I think of that now, how delusional my thinking was. I thought to myself that I could really help these other people, or I could be, that could be good for me. But I don't think I know I wanted to stop, but I wasn't willing to get sober myself. That's the kind of thinking I had. So God's always been there for me. If you feel like you're not close enough to God, know that he's not the one that moved. I have a thing when I speak a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I share a lot, and I've heard many things say that where we put God first and family and all this and that. I put Alcoholics Anonymous first in my life, because this is just how I see it. God's love for me has never changed. God loved me so much to get me through all those times. So I don't have to put God first, because he's a part of me and he's always been with me. But my life did not change until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm clear on what's changed my life and how God's played a part in that. And when I think of that poem early on, one of my favorite poems was Footprints in Sand. And, you know, I think a lot of you probably heard that. I don't know if I can quote it perfectly now, but basically what it is that when this guy's walking along the beach, and he looks, you know, down the sand during the most difficult parts of the times of his life, there was only one set of footprints. And He asked God, why the most difficult time of my life would you leave me, God? Why would you leave me when I was struggling the most? And he said, my dear child, I would never leave you. But those were the times I carried you. And that's why I say, I know God's always been with me. He's carried me through all those tough times. And, so that step three to me is very important. You know, I made a decision. I live in God's will today. And the last add on my thing about God, one of the things I struggled with was predestination before I got here, because I learned in church about that. It kind of didn't make sense to me, because in the way I was hearing it was like, well, if there's predestination, I can pretty much do whatever I want to do because everything's kind of set up. So I thought of this, that when I told you I met my wife at that 7-Eleven, and we've created this life of what we've known each other over 44 years. We have two children. And a couple years ago, I spent a lot of time thinking about God and all these things and what it all means or whatever. And I had this thought about that because I've told this story about the 7-Eleven so many times. And it hit me that me and my friends were in a car and we were going to a party. I was there to buy beer at the 7-Eleven. And my wife and her sisters were there. And I remember walking up and she's told me since, I think one of my friends asked her to go to a party or however it happened. But I asked her, we ended up going to the party. My friend asked her to go and we ended up going to this party. But I couldn't help but thinking after that, what if I'd hit a red light? If I'd have walked in that 7-Eleven 15 seconds, 30 seconds later, and I would have never met her, a whole world would be different. And I think that's the best way I can describe predestination, in the sense of God has a plan. It was meant for me to meet her. Will we have met some other way? I don't know. It didn't happen that way. But I am 100% relying upon God. God is everything. God is good all the time. Me, not so much. Constant battle of flesh versus spirit. So I've made that decision. Step four says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I love the inventory process of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've already talked a little bit about it, how I've seen my life through the time of doing a four-step. And the first four-step I did, it was pretty brief, in the sense of it was just enough to get me to see how selfish I was. And one of the best examples I can give, during those teenage years, I'd become a really good baseball player. I mean, I was like the star of the team. I was, I was like the top all-star. I wasn't only the best player on my team. I was like the best player in Simi Valley, or one of the top five. I was the pitcher, the shortstop, all the way from the age of 7 years old with the little like T-ball things. I started all the way to 15 years old, 14, 15. I was the all-star. I had tons of baseball cards. I was going to be a major league baseball player. I mean, that whole time through when I go to Nan's house, I was just in my head, I was going to be a major league. I was going to be like Pete Rose. But I also told you about how I started drinking at 11 and doing all that. So from 11 to all those years too, all that had increased. And so they told me to do an inventory. And so one of the things I wrote down, they said, write down somebody you resent. And so I wrote down this baseball coach. I thought back, as a kid, this baseball coach, I still remember going to the office. I was going a freshman going into high school, and I'd already had some scouts looking at me from like the San Francisco Giants. I remember people coming, they told my dad or somebody, this kid's really good. He goes through high school. We're going to keep an eye on him. And so I'd go to the high school. I think back then it was 10th grade. Is when I went to high school, and I'm going to be on the baseball team, and I go try out. And one day the coach called me in his office, says, I'm going to cut you from the team. And I'm like, you're going to cut me from the team? I mean, I don't know what I said, but I couldn't believe it. And I'd written down that this is the coach I resented. And he told me to write down why. Why did I resent him? Because he cut me from the team. He cut me from the team, and he ruined my whole life. I was going to be a baseball player, and this coach had the gall to cut me from the team. But then there's that part, the third part, right? Where look, what was my part of it? So I started looking back. Why did he cut me from the team? Well, he cut me from the team because I was smoking. He says, I saw you smoking cigarettes outside the school campus. It was a lunch break or something. I drove out and we were out there smoking with all these guys. And I was probably doing drugs too or whatever I was doing. And I never once thought to look at my part in that situation. I always just blamed him for things that I'd caused. And that would continue through my life, not really looking at the chaos I was creating, you know, looking at other people. That's just one of the examples how the inventory process has worked in my life. It's taught me to, whenever I'm disturbed or something wrong with me, it's not the other person. It's taught me to look. We get to step 10, you know, a continuation of step 4 after we've completed 4 through 9. You know, we have step 10 that we continue to take personal inventory. And I do that today when I recognize something because of that 4th step. And I also think the principle behind the 4th step is courage. You know, I love the principle of Alcoholics Anonymous too. It took me a while to kind of figure out, like, live the steps, work the steps. What I've come to see in the 12 step, like I said, it's a practice each principle in all my affairs. So, you know, the principles of honesty and hope and faith. And step 4 principle is courage. And for the first time, one of the definitions of courage I heard was the ability to walk through fear, walk towards fear, and keep going. So it's allowed me to walk through the difficult times of my life. You know, step 5, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of wrong. I did that 4th step. I wrote that down. I recently, at 7 years of sobriety, I got a new sponsor, and I redid an inventory process of really digging deep, you know. And like I said, I kind of just scratched the surface my first time. But with 7 years of sobriety, I got a sponsor and really dug deep into all the stuff. And, you know, I found out some things about me. And for the last 4 years, I've been still learning about myself through that, by admitting to that sponsor stuff and learning. You know, step 6 says, we're entirely ready to have God remove these character defects. And why is the great need for step 4 and 5? Because it just said I'm going to have to remove character defects. And, you know, here I didn't even think I had it. I mean, you know, there's, and I've come to see I have many character defects. And the principle behind step 6 is willingness. You know, I just have to be willing to look at these things and learn about myself. Step 7 says, you know, we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. So I have to be willing and humble to look at my part and have God take me to better things. And that humility is a hard one, because it's hard to be humble when you're not. I got this one little story I like to tell. I got another story about a couple guys. There was this farmer, and he had this buddy, and him and his buddy went up to one day. He says, you know, I'll call him Farmer John, because usually if I'm looking at somebody, I'll pick out somebody, but I don't see nobody that I want to pick out here. So I'll say Farmer John, and, you know, that's the farmer we all know about. So his friend comes up and says, how you doing today, Farmer John? He says, well, I'm doing good, but there's something I just can't explain. And his friend says to him, well, what do you mean? He says, well, I went in to milk the cow the other day, and I'm getting down, I'm milking her, and got the pail under there, and I'm milking away. And just as the pail gets filled up with milk, the cow's leg kicks the bucket over. And he says to his friend, there's some things you just can't explain. He said, well, farmer, what'd you do then? He said, well, I'm not about to give up. So I looked over and thought, well, maybe the cow's a twitchy leg. So I tied I got some rope, and there was a post there. So I tied the cow's leg to the post. I get the pail back under there. I start milking away again. And just as the pail gets filled up with milk again, the other leg comes over and kicks the pail over again. And his friend says to him, well, what'd you do then? He said, well, there's some things you just can't explain. So he says, well, I'm not about to give up now. Now I'm getting kind of angry at this cow, because I think the cow's doing this on purpose, you know, not just a twitchy leg. So there's another post, there's a little more rope. So I tie the cow up. I got the cow's leg spread, tied up. Now I got him. I get down there. I start milking away. Pail's just about filled up with milk. Tail comes down and kicks the pail over with his tail. And he tells his friend, there's some things you just can't explain. And he said, well, what did you do then, Farmer John? He said, well, now I know this cow's messing with you. I'm not about to give up. So I look around. There's no more rope. And there's a post up above the cow, though. So the cow's legs are spread eagle apart. He's tied up like that. He can't move it. I look around. There's no more rope. So I think, well, I'll use my belt. I remember that morning, too. I hadn't worn any underwear, but I thought, well, that'll be okay. But I take the belt, and I take the cow's tail, and I tie the belt around the cow's tail. I tie it up around the beam up above so the cow's tail sticking straight up in the air. You spread eagle like that. I'm standing there, and just then my pants fall down. And like I said, I didn't even wear any underwear. So there I'm sitting, you know, behind the cow, and just then my wife walks in, and there's some things you just can't explain. I can't explain why I was gifted with sobriety and some other people weren't, but I know I'm grateful to be sober, and I've learned a little bit about humility. Step 8, we became willing to make amends. We made a list of all the people we're willing to make amends to, and I know in that list I take people through now, it just says I make the list, and it's interesting that in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, right after that seventh step, you know, Bill says we have a list of the people we've harmed. And isn't that amazing how that we have a list? So what's the list he's talking about? He's talking about the list of the resentments that I had towards other people. And I've come to see that those people that I thought so bad, you know, and I guess how would I make that amends to that baseball coach? I mean, you know, really, I guess because the way I talked about him my whole life, blaming him for something for just doing his job. So he would be on that list. You know, and if I ever ran into him, you know, I mean, I don't know. But that's how that process works. We make the list. And we make direct amends to such people harmed us, step 9. I'm going to, you know, like I said, I love the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I have a couple of stories in my life that have shown what Alcoholics Anonymous has done. Who I used to be and who I am now and how it's changed my life. And that's why I'm going to talk about how I make my amends today, my living amends, the way the process I clearly see for me. If you look at steps 1 through 9, what I just talked about, every one of those steps, the way it's written is past tense. It says we admitted we were powerless. It says we made. It says we made a list. We made a searching for all those things are things that I've done, things that we should do. It's very interesting when we get to step 10, though, you know, the wording, if you pay attention, huh, what it says, it's no longer past tense. Step 10 says we continue to take personal inventory and wrong prompt and meditate. Step 11 says stop through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, as we understood. And step 12, like I've already said, we practice these principles in all our affairs. So we continue, we improve, and we practice. So I do 10, 11, and 12 every day. And those amends, one of the things that's happened in my life, I have 2 children. And my I have a daughter and a son. My son's I think 36 now. My daughter's 33, something like that. They're getting older. But my son was he's such a good man. He's never really struggled with this thing. But I guess I'm 50-50 because my daughter, at the age of 18, she started dabbling in this stuff that we do. And, she was like this child that was this blue-eyed, blonde-haired child that everybody just loved. She always like daddy's little girl, my little angel, you know. At the age of 18, we put her in that, like, that Christian school, like I said. And I don't know, something happened, a boy came over there, and all of a sudden she met this boy from another school that came there, and it seemed like ever since she met him, she started to change. She started getting into this thing that we did. she started doing things that fathers don't want to think about their little girls doing. She would disappear from our life for a while. She lived with us still, but she wouldn't come home. And, I have an interesting story about that too. If any of you guys, just give you my experience with a child of addiction. I wasn't sober yet either. I had no recovery. You know, when she's going through this, I think at the age of, she was 19 or 20, she'd gotten in a lot of trouble. We thought she was going to die. She would be away. She got arrested many times. And, came a time where we put her in rehab. And I remember this, I share with people that don't try to tell your kids what to do. You know, she was in a recovery center in Pasadena, a rehab. And they had this Al-Anon program where we'd go, me and my wife would go and go down and visit her. My wife went religiously. I went a couple times. I was still messed up myself. But I remember this one time I went and I talked to her. How you doing? She says, you know, her name's Christine. She says, oh, I'm doing all right, Dad. And she says, but when I get out, I think I'm going to get a tattoo. And this is the way I talked to her and to everybody. I said, there's no daughter of mine's ever getting a fucking tattoo. And said it just like that. I told her, no way it's going to happen. Don't tell your 20-year-old daughter that, but she's one of us, an alcoholic. And we fast forward to when she got out a few months later or whenever it was, a short time after she got out, she went back to doing what she was doing. I remember she came and she said, look at this, Dad. She had a tattoo of a gun on her hip. She had tattoos on her arm, some type of stuff and that. And then on her hands, on her finger, she had tattoos. She put up to me and it said, fuck yeah, tattooed on her fingers. So I don't know. That's not the way to get your daughter or get somebody in recovery to try to do something, telling your kids what they're not going to do. Nobody could have told me what to do. So during that time in there, though, she actually got pregnant in a rehab shortly later, another rehab, I think. Through that, my granddaughter was born, and she'd met this guy. And in the beginning, it seemed like it might be a good guy. I mean, he did. He took care. They got out of rehab together. You know, they started the life together, and she was getting better. You know, she stopped using. She was doing a lot better in life. And like I said, in the beginning, it seemed like he was going to be okay. You know, he was from Europe, Hungary, different kind of culture. But seemed like things were going pretty good. And you fast forward a little bit, they were doing pretty good for those years. And then about, I think, it would have been 4 or 5 years later, she got pregnant again, and this time she had twins. So now she has two twins, two boys that were born, have a granddaughter, and she picked up again and started doing what she liked to do, meth. And it got really bad, guys. I mean, to really, I give so much credit to my wife. She stuck with them that whole time. She was going over there, helped my daughter get through it. And there came a time, though, where they burned all their bridges in North Hollywood where they were living. And the only place they had to come live with us. It was like a nightmare. You know, he was not a good guy. He did not turn out. He was a criminal, an abuser, a con man. And he came and lived with us, him and my daughter and the three grandkids. And it was for a couple of years, it was hell. It really was a year, I think, they lived with us. And it got really bad. And so many things we went through. And she came to me at one point after they'd been living here where over about a year. And she said that he'd been beating her. He'd broke her ribs. And I've had to do a lot of inventory on this, too, because when she told me that, I'm like, how could I not see this happening in my own house? But, you know, later, since talking with her, she says she hit it really good. So she ended up filing charges against her. I took her down to the police. She filed charge. And they said, you'll never be with him again. And I thought things were going to get better. He was out of the house finally. He'd went away. She was here. Me and my wife had some hope that maybe things would get better. But even after a short week after that happened, I could see she was back doing what she was doing. She wasn't acting like she was for that first week, and she started using again, doing something and all that. She had good intentions, but I don't think she could do it. She ended up going back to him after she'd filed charge and doing all these things. And that was just a horrible time for me and my wife. During that time, she went back to him, and there was a point where there were the police. My daughter-in-law was still seeing them. The kids had been taken away from them at some point. And I guess they thought all those things that she accused him of when she went back to him, they decided the best way to get out of that. She decided, my daughter-in-law came and called me one day. And I still remember I was with somebody I was sponsoring in the car, and we'd just done 12-step work. And she said, "Mike, I don't know how to tell you this, but Christine filed a battery report against you. She filed charges against you. She claimed that all those things that her husband did do that I did, they thought that was the way out." And I was devastated. And me and my son came in. I went down to the police station because I thought I was going to be arrested. You know, battery against a child and all that. She filed. I went and talked to the desk sergeant and explained the situation. And they said, "Well, yeah, charges were filed. And a detective will be calling you. You know, we're not going to arrest you right now. We're going to investigate it." And it was a sad time in my life. She went back eventually. She would get away from him for a while. She would end up going to Bakersfield. Get away. She got, and why I have to say the city, I live in the Antelope Valley. She lives in Bakersfield, she'd went to Bakersfield. And she was there, and she disappeared. And there came a time when we didn't even know she was alive. I thought he'd killed her. She stops calling her kids. By now, my son and daughter-in-law had custody of kids. We couldn't take custody of them because the things they'd said about us. So they had custody of the kids. And here's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's still just, she was out there, and she was doing things that she used to do. She'd gotten away from him. Like I said, I don't think she'd seen the kids in 3 or 4 months. And we just couldn't imagine her. She loved her children so much. Those three kids were everything to her. But the power of addiction strong too. And so there came a time where I hadn't heard from her. And mind you too, that I, you know, talk about resentment. I'm not too happy with this girl. Here she turned everything around and put it on me. My wife got a phone call one day and comes to me and says, "Mike, it was Christine. She's in jail. She got arrested and she wants to come home." And I'm thinking to myself, "Yo, now she wants to come home." Yeah, right. You know, so however it came about, my son couldn't go get her. She was about an hour from our house, you know, in a police station where I knew it was. And for some reason, though, all that, when they said she wanted to be picked up, all that resentment and stuff went away. And I just said, "I'll go get her." And guys, I know my little girl, and I thought, she's not going to be there when I get there. You know, it was like 9 o'clock at night, and I got in the car, and I probably got that hour driving about 40 minutes. I remember driving over there thinking to myself, by the time I get there, she's going to be gone. And walk up to this police station, and I still remember it was one of those nights where it was just like quiet and nobody's in there's no cars in the parking lot. I think I'm in the right place. You know, and I pull up and park and start walking in there, and I can see through the glass doors, the desk sergeant in the back. You know, I don't see nobody else, just him, you know, behind a desk and inside. And I walk in there and I'm thinking, "No, she's not here." There's a bench out front. I don't see her. I walk up to him and says, "Hey, I heard my daughter was here," and I told him the name and that. And as I'm talking to him, guys, I hear a voice. It says, "Hi, Dad." And she was sitting over to the side. And I said, "Come on, let's go home." And I don't know, it's just, that's why I give all the credit to Alcoholics Anonymous, because the old me, guys, would have been, this is after I had about 6 years of sobriety at the time. And I didn't judge her and I didn't condemn her. I just said, "Come on, sweetheart, let's go home." she got in the car, and that's why I had to mention the town she was in, because, you know, like I said, we weren't saying much to each other. You know, obviously she was nervous. I was still, I don't know how I felt. I just knew I was glad she was alive. I had Pandora on my radio. I got the music up, listening, and what song comes on the radio is "Have You Ever Walked the Streets of Bakersfield?" And if some of you know that song, it says, you know, "You don't know me. Who are you to judge me? Have you ever walked the streets of Bakersfield?" She looked at me and I looked at her, and it was just a moment that there's another example how God, you know, little miracles, you know, coincidence or God, I don't think so. I think it's showing me something. She came home and she was kicking it from doing some heavy core stuff. And I helped her get through that, you know. She started going the very first day she got home. I called up some of my women friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lady was there that first night. And they took her to a meeting. And over the next couple of weeks, she started going to meetings with me, you know. And we would go to meetings, and I still remember on December 16, 2015, me and her went to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and it was just like me, her, and I think three or four other people there. And she'd been drinking beer every day. I was buying her like some 211s, just trying to help her kick from what she was doing so she could survive. But at this meeting, she said, "I guess today's my sobriety date. I haven't had a beer all day. I'm going to stay sober from now on." And she's been sober since that day. What a miracle, Alcoholics Anonymous. What a miracle that that could happen to me and my child. And now she's working for a treatment center. Those kids, you know, they live with us now. Oh, and that ex-husband. Here's the part of the story too, where you know, I'd always heard that, you know, going to that church and reading the Bible a couple of times, learning. One of the things I always heard that is, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." And I always wondered what that meant. You know, vengeance in mind. What does it mean? God's going to leave it to God. But I had this experience in my life showed me exactly what he meant. Because there would come a time where that son-in-law got in trouble. You know, something besides he beat her. There was charges for the domestic violence, but he picked up another case of attempted murder. And because of this program, I downloaded to find out every court date he had. Every court for that attempted murder. And I went and met the prosecutor. And I told him how he beat my little girl, that he needed to pay for that. He said, "Well, this is another case. This is a bigger case, attempted murder, but certainly that will play into it." But I showed up every day. Every time he had a court case, I was sitting there. When they bring him out, I was sitting there. And he would end up taking a 9-year joint suspended sentence with 5 years probation to get out of that attempted murder charge with all these conditions. And I kept following him. And came a time where he violated a restraining order against my daughter. My daughter went and filed charges. So on one of those, just like those check-in days to make sure he was keeping up with his stuff, there I was in court. And I told the prosecutor, I said, "Hey, he violated a restraining order." And through this whole process, guys, he ended up getting violated. My daughter was able to come testify against him in the probation violation hearing. He got to sit there in court and tell them what he did to her. And this judge, the prosecutor told me, said, "Yeah, they'll usually violate somebody, give them a year, you know, for violating a restraining order, give them a year." This judge, though, knew the whole story. The judge remembered us from before. And he sentenced to 9 years, the full 9 years, and he's still doing time. A couple more years till he gets out. And now I know what vengeance in mind saith the Lord. Because when all that was going on, guys, I wanted to take that punk and put his, you know, get him on his knees and put a gun in his mouth or something. If I would have did that, I'd be paying that price now. I didn't get vengeance. I got justice. I followed the laws and I got justice. God took care of the rest. So those are some of the things that have happened in my life. I'll say this and I'll end is that one of the other miracles that's happened in my life is the many people I've lost. When I had 2 years of sobriety, my father, my hero, my dad, that, you know, through the years, he was just always such, you know, he quit drinking too. I grew up around that, you know, that behavior net. He'd straightened out. He got sober, and he became quite a man. 2 years of sobriety. They found a spot in his lungs that was cancer. And, you know, go back to that grandmother I told you about, Nan. Came a time when she got older before I was sober. And I always said I'll never have Nan go in a nursing home through a set of events. So, you know, I stole her money. I mean, I didn't steal, but if you buy a house for me, I'll take care of her. I'll make sure she's taken care of. And she moved in with us, used her money so I could have a house. And my wife, of course, and kids took care of her. I didn't do nothing. And I was so sick, guys, through a whole set of events that came a time, of course, she ended up in a nursing home because I didn't have the balls to take care of her. And it was destroying my family. So she's in a nursing home. And this is how pathetic I was. I still remember pulling up that nursing home, and I would send my wife in there, and I would sit in the car smoking a joint or something, listening to music, and say, tell Nan how much I love her, because I can't handle the smell of that place. I think when I tell that story, that that's who I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So here, too, like I said, with 2 years of sobriety, with a little bit of the program, and me, my dad's sick. I'm living in the Antelope Valley. They live in Vegas. My dad's sick, and I went there every weekend in this old car I had that barely make it up the hill to Vegas, and I took care of my mom, and I did what I was supposed to. And he had a couple surgeries, and he ended up on a ventilator. Came a time where my mom, after 10 days, they were married for 53 years, and she had to make a decision to take him off the life support. They said he had no hope, and you know, they could put a trach in him, and he'd be. And she knew he would never want that. He would never wake up. So she made that decision, and this is another miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was able to hold my mom's hand and watch my dad take his last breath, and be okay with it. From that guy that couldn't even go in and say hello to his grandmother because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to do that and be there. I was able to go through all those times and also through all that, guys. As soon as that happened, when I left my mom's place, I went to a meeting about Alcoholics Anonymous before I even came back to my own house. This program's always been there for me. All those times going through that, what I talked about with my daughter, I went to a meeting every day. Every single day, I went to a meeting about Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys helped me get through all that. This past year, on July 26th, my mom, the last couple years, she got really, really sick. And she was my best friend. Like, she was barely 16, I said, when she had me. We had a relationship that a father, our mother, and son, I mean, we were just so close. And she got really ill the last few years. She had neuropathy in her feet. And she was such a proud woman, and she couldn't hardly walk anymore. And, she was in an assisted living. My sister was taking care of her. And here's the thing that I wanted to share with you guys. I'll leave you guys with this, that if you have anybody you love, anybody you care about, go home and tell them today how much you love them. Because you never know. With these phones we have, it could light up and our whole worlds can change. So it would have been on July 25th, Saturday night, I'm sitting in, I'm thinking, you know, I should call mom. And I would talk to her every so often, but sometimes she'd be so miserable, and it would be so hard to talk to her. She would just complain and whine. And so it's a Saturday night. I'm thinking about, well, maybe I'll have some fun with my wife. And I'm saying that because I want you to – my mindset was, like, I don't want to call my mom. But something, that God thing, like I was saying, something by doing God's will was telling me, no, call your mom. Just talk. So I called her, and I talked to her for a minute. I remember the phone. She dropped the phone. And guy who got hung up on, I'm thinking to myself, well, I'll just call her tomorrow. Probably wasn't the right time to talk, but I called her back, guys. And here's probably one of the greatest moments of my life up to this point. We had this conversation. I remember, I think she was in a really good mood that night. She was doing okay. Whenever I would talk to her, 9 out of 10 times, I mean, every time I talked to her, I would always end, I love you, mom. And she wouldn't say it to me, and it bothered me sometimes. I would always end it with, like, I love you, mom. She'd say, okay, bye, son. She would hang up. This time, though, she said, I love you, son. She hung up the phone. The next morning, I'm on a Zoom meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, my home meeting at 8 a.m. It's 8 a.m. to 9:30, and about a quarter to nine, my phone rings. Like I said, at any time, my phone lights up, and my sister's name's on the phone. I put the thing on mute because I know I have to take the call. And my sister says, "Mom passed away. She died like a half hour ago. And I'm here with her now." And I almost missed that. Chance to hear, I almost didn't make that phone call. So all those regrets I have for my grandmother and that, with my dad and my mom passing away, though, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have zero regrets. The last words I heard her say to me, "Son, I love you." And that's a direct result of this program teaching me to do the right thing, following that intuitive thought and decision that you guys have taught me. So thank you guys for letting me share. And I'm going to share this one thing about, I'm going to tell this story. There was this alcoholic and he was in a hole. Maybe some of you heard this before, but I'm going to put my own spin on it. So there's this alcoholic in a hole. And he's stuck down in this hole and he can't get out. And just like me, when I was young there, my parents used to tell me, you know, I can remember coming home, you know, when I was 18 or 19, I'd be driving and they would say, "Son, you know, just stop." And I said, "Mom, Dad, I got this. I'll be okay." So this alcoholic in the hole, his parents come by and they talk to him too. But he's still stuck down in the hole just like I was. Just like me, later time came in life where, you know, this alcoholic stuck down the hole. And just like I told you guys, this preacher comes by and starts talking to this alcoholic in a hole just like I tried to go to church. And this is one of the best preachers ever. I mean, he's talking to this alcoholic. He's giving him all this spiritual stuff. Pretty soon he's got to go, you know, go back to his church and pastor there. He can't keep talking to this alcoholic. The alcoholic is still in the hole. After I went to that church thing, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to a psychiatrist. She helped me get to Alcoholics Anonymous. But just like the alcoholic in the hole, the same thing happened to me with the psychiatrist comes by and He'd given this alcoholic in the hole all these medicines. He's starting to feel better, but he's still stuck in the hole. And you guys know what happens next, just like what happened to me. Here comes this guy, and he's just a member of Alcoholics. You ever guys see in meetings one of those old-time guys that just kind of just so calm and peaceful, and he comes by and he starts talking to the alcoholic in the hole. He says, "How you doing?" And the guy says, "Well, you know, I can't stop drinking." And this guy says, "Just a minute." And he jumps down in the hole with him. And this alcoholic thinks, "What the hell, this guy? Now we're both stuck in the hole. What are we going to do now?" But he reaches out his hand to him and says, "I've been where you're at before. Grab hold of my hand. And if we work together, we can both get out of this hole." And that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.